Sims. She's general counsel for Cypress Fairbanks Independent School District. I do have to read this one part about her, though. Because she's the winner of the Texas Monthly's magazine Rising Star Award for Schools and Education Law for 5 consecutive years. She says that was not on her resume, but Bob Googled it.
He did.
To get that out.
And he also didn't say, I got too old for the award. Once you hit 40, you're too old for it. So at least he was kind enough not to put that in there until she aged out. Thank you. And I feel kind of, I told him I feel like Britney Spears, and I guess I'm showing my age, and this kind of looks like a comedy club stage, doesn't it? I feel like I should say, hey. I will be quick. This is actually, and am I loud? Should I whisper? Is that better? Okay. This is actually a presentation that feels a little piecemeal because it was literally questions that were submitted, and I just kind of answered them in PowerPoint. So I apologize if it's a little disjointed, but, Bob added that for me. I have no relevant relationships and products or services described, reviewed, evaluated, or compared in this presentation. And since I don't have any products or services, that's pretty good. One thing I was asked is, how important is documentation, and how detailed should it be, and how long should it be maintained? And what I wanted to point out, or the most important thing about documentation, I won't belabor it, is that your documentation as an athletic trainer, really as a school official, and is most everyone K through 12? Oh, okay, PTs, but you work in the K through 12 environment? Most everybody works in a K through 12 environment? I was just making sure we didn't have any college.
Okay.
But because there are some, as I go through, there may be some nuances when you're talking about an adult student versus a K through 12 student. But we document for a couple of reasons. For one, for your records, so that you can look back in the file and remember Johnny or his injury or where you are in the progression of that treatment. And the other reason that we document, just candidly, is should we ever have to defend our actions? So how much documentation depends upon the purpose of the record and who's going to see or review the record as well. And so if it is truly like a treatment record and you may be sharing it with a physician or you may be sharing it with your assistant athletic trainer, then the way you document, the verbiage that you use, may be up here at this level. And so you don't have to explain things or write them out. If you're documenting or providing information to a parent for them to follow up on treatment or to do certain things, or you're providing it for a teacher or the counselor so that they can assist the student, then you're probably gonna have to explain things a little more, maybe not use industry terms or things that might be misunderstood or misinterpreted. So the degree of documentation, I would primarily say, would focus on who's gonna receive the record. Not just the purpose, but who. And so here's some examples that I was told. I said, give me some examples of documents that you would maintain: injury records, treatment records, rehabilitation records, and then records of parent contact. Now, the parent contact piece, you're really a best practice. I would always document when you make contact with a parent and really the substance of the conversation. However, your individual entity, whether it's a school or you are at a hospital that supports schools, they may have certain expectations and requirements regarding communication with patients and parents, and so look to that first. But generally speaking, I would document anytime you make parent contact. And so along that vein, people then ask, okay, now I've created this documentation, how do I maintain it? And under, I guess, what laws does it have to be maintained and then disclosed? So in the K through 12 environment, we have the word FERPA, and that's, the Family Education Rights Privacy Act, but, we love acronyms, and so we call it FERPA. And then in the healthcare world, you're used to HIPAA. And so here's just a little bit, I'm not gonna read it to you, but this tells you a little bit about each statute, and really kind of counterintuitive, you would think as I'm a K through 12 employee, but I am a healthcare provider, and so between these two, HIPAA should apply to me. But actually, as I said, maybe counterintuitive, FERPA applies to you. Specifically, HIPAA is going to apply to a covered entity, and school districts are not covered entities under HIPAA. And so, and there actually is a specific provision within HIPAA that says if FERPA applies to the record you've created, then FERPA controls, not HIPAA. So then let's talk about what is an educational record that's covered under FERPA. So health records maintained by a school regarding a student are educational records. They're not, it's not protected health information. It's not PHI under HIPAA. It's actually an educational record under FERPA. And this provision, FERPA, is both a sword and a shield for parents. A sword meaning they're going to have an absolute right of access to that record. So that goes back to my, who are we creating this documentation for? Who's going to see it? The parent is going to have a right of access to those records to see them, even if you didn't intend for the parent to be the recipient of that record. They're going to have an absolute right of access under FERPA. But it's also a shield in that a parent has to authorize disclosure of those records to any third party unless you fall within one of the enumerated exceptions under the law. For your benefit, one of the enumerated exceptions under the law is for a fellow school official that has a legitimate educational interest in the record. It can be disclosed to that person without parent permission. But always remember, it's a two-part inquiry. And we can talk more about that later, but I always remind my athletic trainers, my school officials, that just because someone is employed by the school district doesn't mean they have a right of access to the information that you have. They have to have a legitimate educational reason for asking. So a quick example of that might be you're treating Johnny, and Johnny's English teacher is an avid football fan. Johnny's the quarterback, and so she sees you treating Johnny on the sidelines Friday night. Well, then Monday, she sees you and she says, oh my gosh, I saw Johnny on the table. Is he okay? What, you know, is he gonna be able to play on Saturday? What was the diagnosis? That person may have a very innocent reason for making that inquiry, but let's look at our test. Are they a school official? Yes, they're a school official. Do they have a legitimate educational interest in the information? No, they don't. And so in that situation, I mean, you can say, oh, he's good, you know, or yeah, you may be able to make a polite response, but to provide detailed information about that student is inadvisable in that context, particularly if it's derived from educational records. Like, you get information back from the physician. You're maintaining that in your file. You shouldn't disclose that information. Yeah, according to the doctor's report, you know, he has a torn ACL. So that's not an appropriate disclosure. Let's change it a little bit. Say Johnny had a concussion. The information back from the doctor is that he shouldn't be engaging in extended paper pencil tasks or some things as he's recovering from that concussion. Then you have that same English teacher who says, oh my gosh, how's Johnny's, you know, concussion, and is there anything I need to know? Well, actually, yes, it'd be a more formalized process, but then yes, then it would be appropriate because we're a school official and the legitimate educational interest is Johnny can't, you know, finish reading Beowulf this week because he's going to have to limit his, you know, time on task as far as, you know, certain learning situations. So that's kind of an example. Just remember that the educational rights transfer to an adult student, but if the student is still a dependent, then the parent has a right of access to the information, but they no longer make the educational decisions. And that's part of the reason I asked if everybody was kind of K through 12, but even K through 12, you will have, by their senior year, you'll have some students who are adults, or you'll have overage students who reach the age of maturity even prior to their senior year. So those rights transfer. I tell my folks is that if you have a reason to know that the student is no longer being supported by the parents, i.e. they've moved out, or they've actually said to you, you know, I don't have anything to do with my parents, they're not supporting me anymore, then you would have reason to know that you shouldn't be disclosing information to the parent. But other than that, I tell my school folks this too, you know, we don't need to investigate every kid that turns 18. You don't have time for that. Keep up with who turned 18 and what. But it's, so if their situation hasn't changed, you can presume they're still living at home. and that if they're still living at home, then the parent is providing at least 50% of the support, and they would meet the definition under what's called the Buckley Amendment to FERPA, which would allow them access to the educational information of their student. And for those of you who have kids in college or going off to college, this is a good source for you too. And when they tell you, you can't see my grades, well, yes, you can. If you are providing at least 50% of the support, the college will probably make you prove that, show that they're dependent on your tax return, but you can still get access to the educational information. You're just not a decision maker anymore, which I'm gonna have a hard time with. Our girls are friends and have gone to school together since kindergarten, so that's what I'm looking at. They're going to high school next year, so we're dealing with that. I wanted to talk about liability. I was asked directly, talk to me about my immunity. And I know I'm going through this quickly, and I'm doing that so that if you have specific questions at the end, I'm going to try to make time for that. As a school employee, and if you contract with a school district, or if you're employed directly with them, this would apply to you. The education code talks about the professional employee, and that's gonna include pretty much everyone in this room, as I understand, whether you're PT or athletic trainer. And so you're gonna have, under state law, you're gonna have certain immunities, some of the strongest immunities of anyone in the state. And then you're also going to have qualified immunity under federal law. And that's going to be for those due process, liberty interest claims that every once in a while you see when there's been a tragedy, a student's loss of life through they collapse on the football field or something happens. Parents will typically go the federal route and will typically try to turn it into a constitutional deprivation of life or liberty. And so then the qualified immunity under federal law is what kicks in. And you're gonna have to be deliberately indifferent, and that is just a conscious disregard of care for the student in order to lose qualified immunity. It's very rare. There are just a couple of cases I found when I was first preparing for this speech. One where there was a student who collapsed and died, and everyone got sued, including the athletic trainer, and the specific provision in the decision dismissing the case and finding for the school and all of its employees, specifically talking about the athletic trainer piece, they said that the athletic trainer would essentially have to have refused care in order to meet the deliberate indifference standard. And so if you respond and you do what you feel is in your professional judgment what you should be doing at the time, then you're gonna have immunity. And then there's also, for those who may not directly fall under the school employee, say you work for a hospital but you're serving on a concussion oversight team, then the liability for emergency care immunity, then that could potentially apply to you as well. And so you have several layers of immunity, and I think they call it first responders immunity and Good Samaritan immunity, those also apply, and those are also found under state law. I was also asked the question, should you carry personal liability coverage, and does the school district insurance coverage cover me? And so what I would say is if you are a school employee or if you are contracted by the school district, you'd have to look at your specific contract. But generally speaking, if you are an agent of the school district via employee or contract, then the school district insurance is going to cover you if you're acting within the course and scope of your job. Now, if you do an act outside the course and scope of your job, such as engage in an inappropriate relationship with a student, that's not going to be within the course and scope of your job, so you would not have coverage. And I hear a little bit of not chuckling, but I will tell you that's one of the first times I worked in 12 years ago with someone in the athletic training department was an inappropriate student-trainer relationship. So it does occur, just like with coaches, just like with teachers. You interact closely with students, and sometimes people let those barriers down and inappropriately engage in a relationship. So as long as you're not acting outside your course and scope, then you would be covered by the school district coverage. If you elect to have personal liability coverage, or if you have a professional organization and they offer coverage through that organization, it would be supplementary typically to the insurance coverage. I always recommend it. I'm a school district employee and I carry a personal umbrella policy. It's just a personal decision. I do think it's probably a best practice. If you have an organization that you can get coverage through at a reasonable price, I would recommend that as well. I want to say, am I not smart enough? You said point at the cage. Okay, record retention. I've gotten the question, if things are sent electronically, like email, how long do I have to maintain emails? And I always like to circle people back to record retention is not about the medium. An email is no different than a letter. It's about the content of what's in that communication determines how long you maintain it, whether you maintain it, and how long you maintain it. And so for public entities, the state gives minimum retention schedules, but many times entities, both public and private, will have their own record retention that goes beyond the state. And oftentimes it will coincide with auditing cycles and things such as that. So be aware of not just the state requirements, but what your entity requirements are. And I pulled a couple that I thought might be applicable. Under the Texas State Libraries and Archives Commission, for instance, treatment administered to students is a 3-year retention. So you might be thinking to yourself, oh, at the end of each year, I kind of clean out my files and I don't always maintain those. So just keep in mind that what's in a particular record or what's in an email, the content may require retention beyond that current season or beyond that current year. Authorizations, you keep that till the end of the authorization plus 2 years. So if you've been authorized to speak with a physician and you had interactions regarding a student in that file and that authorization expired at the end of the school year, then you would keep it 2 years beyond that. And then I was asked a couple of questions, Title IX, and it does dovetail a little bit into the first lawsuit that I had regarding an athletic trainer, and it was a Title IX action. And I will tell you from that, there are best practices and protocols that we have in place in our district. One of them is treatment of students in an open area, and that when you have student athletic trainers and they're working with you, if they are of the opposite sex, we never recommend doors being closed, and that you, when possible, have someone of the same gender with you. So within your organization, you need to look and see if there are protocols in place to protect you and to protect against potential Title IX claims. Medication administration is a big one that I get from athletic trainers. You know, what medications can I carry? What medications can I give to students, even over-the-counter medications? And it's going to vary greatly by entity. But if you work for a school district, your local policy and a regulation associated with that local policy should tell you. But I would, and you are absolutely going to have parent permission in order to administer even over-the-counter medications. And I would actually caution against the school district purchasing itself and administering medication. I do know that it's not realistic, and I know they come in the treatment room for Tylenol when they've got a headache, and makes me cringe. But so we do still have certain permissions that we do in our district. But as a best practice, you need to have written protocols, and a physician needs to have reviewed your protocols, because before you administer, and probably my physical therapist may be a little more familiar with this than my athletic trainers, but in theory, the physician should have looked at your medication protocol, even for over-the-counter. Like, for instance, it may be if you've got a student under the certain age and they've got a fever, you don't give them a medication that contains aspirin because of Reye syndrome. And so there are certain protocols. So you wouldn't give them a Maalox because it's got aspirin in it if it's a student of a certain age. Whereas if you've not had a physician review your over-the-counter protocols, that might be something that gets missed. And so that, if you are going to do that, you need to have a physician have looked at those and vetted those, and you make sure you have parent permission. Concussion protocols, I know I looked at this. I know y'all talk about that a lot at this, so I'm not going to, at this seminar, I'm not going to belabor it, but I do think that's a growing area for liability for schools and individuals on those concussion protocol teams. There are certain trainings required, even for the physician that's volunteering or even being paid to be on those concussion teams. Many of them volunteer, but for instance, in our district, we pay team doctors. And so be familiar if you serve on a concussion oversight team. Remember the training every 2 years. Make sure that you participate in it. Keep notice yourself of when you're going to have to recertify, and make sure that that's done and the appropriate certificates are with your employer or your school district. Be aware of the return to play and the communication between what is typically going to be your athletic trainer and the physician and the parent, because sometimes the parent won't always give permission to speak directly to the doctor. And so you're relying on information from the parent. And we've had situations where one physician puts the student out and a different type of physician tries to bring the student back. So you may be, you may have had a neurologist put the student out, but then the family pediatrician says the student's okay to return. And then the question may be for you all, can I accept that? And we've actually, you know, dealt with that in our district a couple of different times, and we have required the same class of physician to return the student as put the student out. And so you, as a physical therapist, you may be working with a student and a orthopedic put them out, but you may get a return to play from a pediatrician. And you can say, you know, I, in my professional discretion, I believe I need a release from the same class of physician, and I believe you're perfectly within your right to require that. Because whether or not they return to participate in this extracurricular activity is going to be a decision of the entity. And it's going to be a decision the entity makes based large part probably upon your guidance and expertise. And so if you don't feel comfortable as a licensed professional in this area with that release, then you have the ability to collaborate with your administrators and work to get the appropriate release that you feel comfortable protects both the student and the entity. Conflict of interest in Texas, that changed. And so if you have decision-making authority over with a vendor over certain products, like you are the one, smaller districts, you may be the one that actually purchases certain things with a vendor, and then that vendor, you know, gives you a gift or pays for you to attend a training, or under the new conflict of interest provisions, you may be required to report that. Any gift or service in value of aggregates to $100 or more within a year, then there's a specific conflict of interest disclosure that has to be posted on the school district website. So if you have any questions, talk to your auditor or your CFO in your district and figure out if you are indeed a contract decision maker and whether or not these new conflict of interest laws apply to you. And one question that came in after I did the slide was about the new minimum wage for exempt employees and its applicability potentially to healthcare providers. And yes, it does apply to you. And so if you would need to look to see if your salary is at the minimum threshold, which went from 25.6 now to 45,000 a year, to see if you are still an exempt employee under the Fair Labor Standards Act. If not, then you probably need to have a conversation with the employer about whether or not you are now hourly and how that needs to be documented or reported. Okay, I'm getting the hook. So now I wanted to leave a little bit of time for questions and answers. Yes. Good question. Question is, once an adult student, once they're 18, but still they're a student, and it's time to sign for physicals and things like that. They live with their parents, but they're 18. Who signs? Very good question. The student signs. All the rights and authority as an adult transfers to the student once they turn 18. The only thing that a parent still maintains is an equal right to access to the records. So it doesn't mean the student doesn't have access, it means they both have access. So they can talk with school officials, they can get copies of records, but educational decisions, I'm signing this waiver, I'm signing the permission to participate in athletics, I'm acknowledging the safety protocols that UIL requires, all of that would be the adult student.